From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
To the American public, we hear you and we're working for you. To those who are on the front line in the medical community, we cannot thank you enough. Within this bill, there's more than $140 billion for hospitals. Not just the necessity of the money, but also for the equipment to make sure to keep you safe and actually perform your job. To every small business that is asked to shut down and everyone who works for a small business, now the resources are there for you. If you own a small business, apply for the loan. If you pay your employees, if you pay your rent, and you pay your utilities, that is not a loan. That is a grant. To the others, we have a tax credit for retention to keep your employees working. We will get through this together.
Well, welcome to Washington Watch on this Friday edition. I am your host, Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this, the 27th of March, 2020. Those were remarks from House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy of California, where he delivered his instructions and encouragement in an enrollment ceremony for the CARES Act, its coronavirus relief legislation. The House passed today, nearly unanimously, a $2.2 trillion CARE Act designed to address the fallout from the coronavirus pandemic in the U.S., one that policymakers hope will blunt the impact of the economic destruction from the pandemic. As the stimulus package makes its way to the president for signature, some states are shutting down abortion clinics in an effort to curb non-essential medical procedures and salvage necessary supplies. But abortionists in some states have defied government directives, and I'll have Congressman Roger Marshall of the 1st Congressional District of Kansas to discuss. In my second block, the perpetually offended and recently disgraced Southern Poverty Law Center released its annual hate list in the midst of America's response to the coronavirus, directly on the heels of a report it co-authored with the Center for American-Islamic Relations. The report called for donor-advised funds to blacklist conservatives, all this in the midst of a pandemic. Former U.S. Attorney General and former U.S. Senator from Alabama Jeff Sessions will join me to discuss the SPLC's profiteering and poor timing. At the bottom of the hour, primaries are postponed, school is delayed, and the Olympics are postponed. But what about November elections? How will the spread of and defense against the coronavirus affect general elections in this high-stakes season? FRC's Senior Fellow for Human Rights and Constitutional Governance, Ken Blackwell, will talk with me about what's at stake. And in the last block of today's show, China's manipulation and malfeasance continues. The most recent reports from Chinese state-run media tout an alleged successful double lung transplant to treat the coronavirus and its aftermath. But this is amid growing evidence that the Communist Party is harvesting the organs of political prisoners and religious minorities to sell on the black market. Well, I'll have Ethan Gutman, investigative reporter and author of The Slaughter, Mass Killings, Organ Harvesting, and China's Secret Solution to its Dissident Problem, on air to discuss. A reminder for all of you listening, TonyPerkins.com is our podcast website. There we will have more information on today's guests and the associated resources. You can also find us on all of your standard podcast platforms. Social media, follow Tony at T. Perkins, or me if you'd care to, at Sarah P. Perry. Well, the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, also known as the CARES Act, has now passed the House and the Senate, and it's on its way to the president. This is a $2.2 trillion package that will provide relief to Americans across the country. Now, it's filled with things that we like that will benefit us as Americans and specifically as religious Americans, but there are a few elements that were unnecessary. And speaking of those, abortion clinics in three states are claiming to provide essential medical services by continuing abortion operations during the outbreak, defying state orders to temporarily cease while they do it. So joining me now to talk about it is Representative Dr. Roger Marshall, who serves Kansas's 1st Congressional District. Representative, thanks so much for being on with me today.
You bet, sir. Proud to be on with you. Gosh, you had quite a news of the reel you just went through there. What are we going to talk about first?
Well, I tell you what. First, let's talk about the CARES Act, because this has been the news on everyone's mind. We have been on the edge of our seat waiting to see if this would pass. After much debate on the floor today, it passed nearly unanimously. So tell us, if you would, Congressman, what people like me can be excited about in this package.
Well, number one is it's going to protect your health. So it's going to get the supplies, the resources that your doctors and nurses need to take good care of you and your family should you get this virus. So that's number one. Number two is it's going to help families out. It's going to get people like you a check for $1,200 most likely. And if you have children, $500 per child as well. So many American families are going to get about $3,000 of funding from the government to help us through this next month or so. And then finally, some really good help, like Kevin McCarthy was talking about there in your intro, for small businesses. They start off as loans, but then they become a grant as long as you keep working. You're using them to pay for your rent, your utilities, and to keep your employees on board. So I think it's a great several steps here, and now we can really focus in on our health.
Well, I think also in addition to that, I know we at FRC and myself individually were encouraged about the payment protection program, how small businesses, nonprofits, churches, organizations with under 500 individuals are actually going to benefit from this as well. It allows us to keep doing essential and critical work during this time. But we know, because we know Nancy Pelosi's aims in all of this, and that 2 weeks ago she was trying to find an $8.3 billion back door to make sure that there would be coverage for abortion services. There are a couple of things that we don't like. So talk about those issues.
Well, you know, of course, Nancy Pelosi is always going to find a back door for Planned Parenthood funding, the largest abortion provider in the country right now. So she delayed this last legislation for 5 days. And in those 5 days, 800 Americans died, 40,000 Americans got the coronavirus, and millions of dollars were lost. So she's always very willing to put her politics ahead of Americans' health. So it's been very frustrating, but we stood up to him. Kevin McCarthy did a great job. Leader McConnell over in the Senate job, standing up to her and saying, no, we're not going to use any of this funding for Planned Parenthood. So very proud of it, the Republican stance here.
Now, a lot of state governors have taken the appropriate action to put a temporary halt to all abortion services, arguing not only that it's not medically necessary, but that there needs to be a conservation of these desperately needed personal protective equipment supplies, PPEs, as they're known now. So they have, a couple of these states, instituted these temporary bans. For example, Texas was one state. Texas AG Ken Paxton declared that abortion providers have to postpone all surgeries and procedures that aren't immediately medically necessary. This is supposed to be in place until April 21st, and he was promptly slapped with a lawsuit by the big abortion lobby. So let's talk a little bit, as somebody who knows this issue intimately, let's talk about whether or not abortion is medically necessary.
No, I've never seen one. I've never seen one instance where it was. I've delivered over 5,000 babies, and I never saw an instance when it was medically necessary, that there was always an alternative to saving the mom and the baby, that there was always some way we could do it. So I'm really confused why they would ever consider any type of abortion procedure urgent. Let's use the word urgent, that every abortion is elective. So it just baffles you why they think that this procedure is more important than, say, someone getting their knee replaced or an arthroscope done on their knee. So that they expect special treatment for this because it's an abortion. You know, just the opposite, that those should be delayed. And like you said, save the PPEs, because it's just not the equipment that's used on the case. There's lots of complications from abortions that we have to take care of our emergency room. And then just the spread of the virus, burning out, spray the virus to the other nurses. So it's just one more way of hurting our system right now. We need all hands on deck for this coronavirus to protect Americans.
I agree with you, Congressman. And I have to say that obviously we understand Planned Parenthood and its ilk really have profits, hearing, and profitability top of mind. Their goal is always more money. It is always more abortions. And even the temporary ban, which other industries have taken to immediately and with understanding, whether those are small businesses, everything from school districts postponing or delaying education to small businesses in operation, individuals who will distinctly suffer for a time period for the greater good to maintain health and safety. I find it very interesting, but not surprising, that Planned Parenthood and related abortion clinics have come out in force saying, this is ridiculous. We'll see you in court. So to me, again, we have three governors. I know among them, Texas, Louisiana, and Ohio have all said, listen, for the greater good, we need to put a pause on this. There are other medical procedures that we've also put a pause on. We need every resource available to us. This is a national crisis. And yet, Planned Parenthood doesn't seem to understand how to perform that calculus.
Right. So there will not be an industry that's not impacted from this virus. I mean, think of a dental office, optometrist's office, doctor's offices, all of us delaying these elective surgeries. And I think the tough ones are, you know, talking to doctors like, it's time for the routine colonoscopy, it's time for the routine mammogram. Do we delay a mammogram, and are we going to miss a breast cancer, or is it going to metastasize because we waited a month? So how in the world could you put an abortion clinic ahead of those types of things? So we're all making the sacrifice, then they need to make the sacrifice as well. So it's, to me, it's just Kansas common sense.
It's interesting to me that the editorial board at the New York Times recently published a piece just yesterday about how we need to make abortion more available during the pandemic, not less. And they actually called for the expansion of abortion availability, making more abortion pills available by mail, providing birth control for everybody. And I'm thinking that's really sort of missing the giant elephant in the room right now. If you could make that argument with a straight face when we are facing a medical emergency in this country, well, I tell you what, we're probably never going to see eye to eye. I'd love your thoughts on that New York Times op-ed about calling for the expansion as opposed to the temporary halt.
I'm just baffled. You know, I'm not just reading. I don't read the New York Times too often, but I just have no idea where they're coming from. I know that I'm just baffled I went to Congress to protect the unborn, to protect life in general, and especially the most vulnerable, which are the unborn. So I can't even understand the logic at all. I know that there's some writings out there, oh my gosh, this virus might be horrible for pregnant women. And fortunately, I'm not seeing that. I've seen a few rare cases where the baby was born with the virus, but we're not seeing any type of congenital anomalies caused by the virus. Hmm. We're not seeing moms get any extra sick as well, so we're very, very fortunate. So far, so good with my pregnant women tolerating the virus. I hope they don't get it. And we need to keep a special eye on that, but I have no idea. I just can't follow the logic of the New York Times.
Congressman Roger Marshall of Kansas's 1st Congressional District, also known as the Big First. Thanks so much for joining me today. Well, I'm going to talk next to former U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who is also the former senator from Alabama that happens to be the home for the Southern Poverty Law Center, who felt it necessary to release their hate list in the middle of a national pandemic. He'll join me right after this to talk to me about profiteering and terrible timing.
Is historic masculinity lost forever? Where can boys, young men, husbands, and fathers find a model of manhood, leadership, and strength in a culture of gender confusion? We need men to be men, tough with compassionate strength, bent toward justice without compromise, locking arms and standing. We need to be the men God created us to be and fight for all that is right, true, and just. This is Tony Perkins inviting you to join us at a Stand Courageous Men's Conference. To find out more, go to standcourageous.com. This conference is led by men who are seasoned, compassionate men who understand the issues of the day and will invest in you, helping you understand your role as a defender, a provider, an instructor, a battle buddy, and a chaplain so that you can have the generational influence that God has designed you to have. Learn more at StandCourageous.com. That's StandCourageous.com.
Did you know that Planned Parenthood is the primary supplier of abortions in the U.S.? According to Planned Parenthood's most recent annual report, it committed over 345,000 abortions in fiscal year 2018. That means, on average, Planned Parenthood aborted 1,768 babies every single day in 2018. And while Planned Parenthood's report revealed an increase in abortions committed, many of the services they provide, such as breast exams and cancer screenings, have drastically decreased. FRC recently released its 2020 edition of The Real Planned Parenthood, Leading the Culture of Death. In this resource, you will find many facts revealing the truth, that Planned Parenthood is in the business of abortion, not healthcare. To access this resource and to find out more, go to frc.org/Planned Parenthood Facts. That's frc.org/Planned Parenthood Facts.
We can all benefit from a good lecture. They inform you and grow you. But sometimes you can't make it in person to every talk, seminar, or lecture you'd like to. Fortunately, Family Research Council now has a new podcast so you won't miss out. FRC's new weekly podcast called Lecture Me was created to help inform and equip listeners on the biggest issues affecting our culture today. Each episode presents a lecture selected from the archives of the FRC Speaker Series. Our podcast features today's top thinkers who address important issues like religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture, all from a biblical worldview. Make sure to stay tuned after each lecture to hear FRC's thoughts on the content as they further discuss the topic at hand. The Lecture Me podcast is available wherever podcasts are found, or visit frc.org/podcasts.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. It is Friday, the 27th of March, 2020. I am Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins this afternoon. Well, an organization I happen to know just a little bit about, the Southern Poverty Law Center, claims to be a champion of civil rights. But as we've learned, as have painfully so many others, it is civil rights for some. In the middle of the nation's response to this international pandemic, a time for unity and cooperation, the SPLC has released its annual hate list of organizations that includes ours, the Family Research Council, next to racist skinheads and neo-Nazis. So joining me now to talk about the SPLC's profiteering and poor timing is former U.S. Attorney General and former U.S. Senator of Alabama, Jeff Sessions. Senator, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Sarah. It's good to be with you. And I can say with great earnestness that the Family Research Council is not a hate group.
Well, thank you. We so appreciate that endorsement from an individual of your stature and influence, sir. And I have to tell you, we have sort of borne the brunt of much of the animosity from the SPLC for quite some time. But as someone whose home state is Alabama, I would love to get your take. And you issued a press release recently about what precisely the problem is with an organization that really used to have some chops in the civil rights movement.
Well, it did, and indeed, I was there at the beginning. Morris Dees we prosecuted the case, eventually got the death penalty for an individual who murdered a young black man for no reason other than the fact that he was black, and then he hung his body from a tree in Mobile. Morris Dees, who founded the group, sued the Klan and had a sort of conventional legal theory of liability against the Klan. He won a big verdict and forfeited the Klan's headquarter building. And it was a scary thing. I mean, he had some courage to take them on, and he prevailed, and we helped as I could as having prosecuted the case. So I saw in that a commitment to civil rights, but it just completely flipped it seems to me. Mm-hmm. They don't believe in rights, it seems, for anybody who doesn't agree with them, doesn't agree with their left-wing politics. They define persons who believe in scriptural authority as hateful. This just cannot be. A group like this needs to be called out. I did criticize them Family Research Council is one of the most mainstream, popularly supported groups in the country, and it was not a hate group. So the Alliance Defending Freedom, I didn't list in that group, but a group I work with a lot, the Citizenship and Immigration Service, who advocates for a lawful system of immigration, they listed them too, and a lot of other groups like Federalist Society and Heritage Foundation that I've worked with, they attack on a regular basis. So this is not an acceptable thing. I think it's time to push back, and I'm glad that you and the Research Council is willing to defend itself and push back.
Well, I find it interesting also, and I think we're hearing less about this because the hate list is sort of their preeminent annual offering. But just 2 weeks prior to that revelation of the hate list and during sort of the beginning, the upswing of how we were needing to deal with the coronavirus issue in our own land, it came on the heels of a report it co-authored with the Center for American Islamic Relations targeting the $121 billion charitable industry, essentially calling on donor-advised funds to cut off hate groups, again, air quotes, because it turns out everybody on their list almost exclusively is a conservative, traditional, or orthodox organization. So this is, they're sort of getting two bites at the apple on this. It's not just that we're on the infamous hate list. It's also that they want to cut off the funds that are coming to us by donations through other individuals and through other employees. So they've got a real partisan bent on their attempts to absolutely disenfranchise, shut down, and separate from lawful society, from open discourse, actually remove them from the public sphere, any organization with whom they disagree. And in fact, years ago, as you know, Mark Potok, who used to be with the SPLC, said our mission in life is to destroy these groups. But you're down in Alabama. Has there been much shakeup after the fact that we've discovered this report on sexual harassment and racial discrimination within the SPLC? Are you seeing changes there in Alabama?
Well, I'm not sure we've seen the changes. The list is still out. And they, you know, issued it again just a couple of weeks ago. So I don't know that they stopped doing that. However, a number of the people have been dismissed, I understand. Mm-hmm. That's been public. They do have some new leadership. Indeed, it's important because, what do they have, $300 million in the bank?
Well, $425 million in assets. There you go.
There's a bunch of it in offshore accounts. So they've been this fantastic money machine that's just an unhealthy thing. So the original foundation of it, of taking on Klan and other groups like that that are denying equal rights for American citizens, that has flipped into some sort of attack on conservative groups. You're exactly right. And this culture that they've developed of sexism and racism and financial concerns have, in fact, resulted in some changes in the leadership. But I don't know that they've changed their policy. Perhaps you've seen that better than I.
Well, I can tell you the answer to that is no, unfortunately. It looks like a big change, but in reality, it's the exact same political machine trying to defame those that they don't agree with. Former U.S. Attorney General and former Senator of Alabama, Jeff Sessions, has been my guest today. Well, coming up, we're going to talk elections, but elections within the age of coronavirus. Ken Blackwell, FRC Senior Fellow for Human Rights and Constitutional Governance, will join me right after this.
Oh, What are you reading this spring? At FRCblog.com, we have timely and original commentary on the issues facing our culture today. Our blog is written by our policy experts, the Family Research Council team, and outside contributors. On our blog, you can read about a wide variety of topics, including religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture. Some of our most recent blog posts include, "To abandon the nuclear family ideal is to abandon being human." "Why does the abortion industry hate women?" "China uses coronavirus to oppress religious minorities," and many more. At Family Research Council, our mission is to advance faith, family, and freedom in the culture by helping you to live out your faith and to stand for truth. With our blog, we hope to help you do that. Stay informed and get the resources you need at FRCblog.com. Again, that's FRCblog.com.
The Fairness for All Act was recently introduced to the House of Representatives after the passage of the Equality Act. In response, FRC has come out with a new publication, The Unfairness of the Fairness for All Act. This act attempts to find a compromise between the First Amendment protection of religious freedom and the demands of the LGBT community. Despite having the best intentions, it is an ill-advised and poorly drafted bill that does not achieve its goal. If this act is passed into law, it would allow the federal government to impose a belief system and ideology about sexual behavior and identity on all Americans. The Fairness for All Act would negatively impact religious freedom, true equality, and the privacy and safety of women. To access this resource and to learn more, go to frc.org/fairnessforall. That's frc.org/fairnessforall.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. This is Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Friday, the 27th of March, 2020. Well, some good news, and that relief seems to be headed on the way to small businesses and nonprofits, charities, hardworking Americans, healthcare workers, individuals who are affected on a day-to-day basis by the coronavirus pandemic. It is now the CARES Act headed to the president for signature, but what does the future of life with coronavirus look like, and how will it affect the November elections? Can we guarantee their integrity? Well, joining me now to talk about it is FRC's Senior Fellow for Human Rights and Constitutional Governance, Ken Blackwell. Ken, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Sarah, good to be with you.
All right, so let's start with November. We're going to have to fast forward a little bit. We've seen the suspension of the Olympics temporarily, the suspension of school in multiple states, my state, my home state of Maryland being one of them. There is no aspect of everyday life that has not yet been affected, and multiple primaries have already pushed out their dates. So let's talk November. We're heading into the general elections. What does this look like in the age of coronavirus?
First, let me state, Sarah, that in 1918, the United States elections were conducted in the middle of the Spanish flu pandemic and World War One. There was a drop-off in participation, but there was no abandonment of the electoral code of and practices of the country. Mm. As we head towards November, there's every reason to anticipate that the economic and health, public health dimensions of this pandemic will be under control. So what we're going to see is a change in behavior for primaries. You'll see primaries move back. You'll see primaries like Ohio, was scheduled to have its primary on March the 17th, they have now moved to all-mail voting to be ended on April 27th. But they still anticipate being able to take good health practices and the state will be in an economic position to conduct the elections in November on a regular under the regular regime.
Is there any possibility, and obviously no historical basis, so this would be the first of its kind, to actually postpone the November election? And if so, would that do damage to our constitutional republic?
There's no indication that there's any thought being given to postponing the election. That's why I started out with the 1918 election. The Spanish flu pandemic was much more deadly than this pandemic. We were in the middle of World War One, but Americans saw our constitutional republic, its lifeline being the elections. There were adjustments made. There was some fall off in participation. It was not a presidential election, but it actually does give us a glimpse to how Americans feel about elections. What we saw under the whole notion that you never let a good crisis go to waste was the Democrats tried to pad this response to the pandemic with big government pork barrel initiatives, not only to the Kennedy Center, but they were mandating that the federal election be an all-male election, mail voting election. They were talking about same-day registration, which was going to be fascinating to see how you pull that off.
Right.
So I think right now we're looking at this on a state-by-state basis. I gave you the Ohio example. We will see, again, not postponement, but we will see dates changed on election dates changed on the primary process. But there's every reason to believe that we'll have a plan in place that will allow us to carry out the November election in as normal a way as possible.
There are some people who are saying that this shouldn't be a partisan issue, whether or not we extend any of the voting deadlines or we institute measures to guarantee voting by mail in increased capacity, or that we require things like same-day registration. Do you think this is a partisan issue?
This is an issue of, look, of the integrity of our system. At the end of the day, there has to be a buy-in to the results of any given election, but most notably a presidential election. And so making sure that there are clear and transparent rules and that we don't abandon rules and practices and ways that have, in fact, served this nation for decades and centuries.
Ken Blackwell, FRC Senior Fellow for Human Rights and Constitutional Governance, who I always like talking to, has been my guest in this hour. Well, in my final block of the day, Chinese malfeasance continues. They have touted, Chinese state-run media, that is, and that is the Communist Party, that there has been a successful double lung transplant in response to the coronavirus. But can we trust what the government is saying, and does it fall in line with what we're seeing in terms of organ harvesting? Well, I'll have Ethan Gutman, an investigative reporter and author of a book on mass killings and organ harvesting in China, up next on Washington Watch.
Where can young men, husbands, and fathers find a model of real manhood, leadership, and strength in today's culture of gender confusion? This is Tony Perkins inviting you to join us at a Stand Courageous Men's Conference led by men who are seasoned, compassionate men who understand the issues of the day and will help you understand your role as a defender, provider, instructor, battle buddy, and chaplain so that you can have the generational influence God has designed you to have. Learn more at StandCourageous.com.
Recently, a bill called the Fairness for All Act was introduced to the House of Representatives. In response, FRC has a new resource, the Unfairness of the Fairness for All Act. This act attempts to find a compromise between the First Amendment's protection of religious freedom and the demands of the LGBT community. But, unfortunately, it is a poorly drafted bill that would negatively impact religious freedom, true equality, and the privacy and safety of women. Learn more at frc.org/fairnessforall.
Did you know that Planned Parenthood is the primary supplier of abortions in the U.S.? According to Planned Parenthood's most recent annual report, it committed over 345,000 abortions in fiscal year 2018. That means, on average, Planned Parenthood aborted 1,768 babies every single day in 2018. And while Planned Parenthood's report revealed an increase in abortions committed, many of the services they provide, such as breast exams and cancer screenings, have drastically decreased. FRC recently released its 2020 edition of The Real Planned Parenthood, Leading the Culture of Death. In this resource, you will find many facts revealing the truth, that Planned Parenthood is in the business of abortion, not healthcare. To access this resource and to find out more, go to frc.org/Planned Parenthood Facts. That's frc.org/Planned Parenthood Facts.
We can all benefit from a good lecture. They inform you and grow you. But sometimes you can't make it in person to every talk, seminar, or lecture you'd like to. Fortunately, Family Research Council now has a new podcast, so you won't miss out. FRC's new weekly podcast, called Lecture Me, was created to help inform and equip listeners on the biggest issues affecting our culture today. Each episode presents a lecture selected from the archives of the FRC Speaker Series. Our podcast features today's top thinkers who address important issues like religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture, all from a biblical worldview. Make sure to stay tuned after each lecture to hear FRC's thoughts on the content as they further discuss the topic at hand. The Lecture Me podcast is available wherever podcasts are found, or visit frc.org/podcasts.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Friday afternoon. TonyPerkins.com is our podcast webpage. There you can find resources and links for the information that we are sharing with you today. Also, find our podcast on any one of your preferred podcast platforms. You can find us there, too. Follow Tony on Twitter at T Perkins or me at Sarah P. Perry. Well, it appears that China's communist rhetoric and its secrets continue unabated in the era of American coronavirus dealings. Most recent reports from Chinese state-run media tout an alleged successful double lung transplant to treat the coronavirus. Now, that might give us pause if it were coming from any country other than China, but evidence is mounting that the Communist Party is harvesting the organs of political dissidents and religious minorities to sell on the black market. This is taking place while Chinese officials are moving forward with expelling almost all American journalists, from the Washington Post to the New York Times to the Wall Street Journal, and removing them from China for what else? Accurate coverage of the situation on the ground. So joining me now to talk about China's dark secret is investigative reporter and author of The Slaughter, Mass Killings, Organ Harvesting, and China's Secret Solution to Its Dissident Problem, Ethan Gutman. Ethan, welcome from across the pond. Glad to have you.
Oh, no, I'm actually over here now.
Oh, well, that makes it so much easier for us, doesn't it?
That's right. I'm up in Vermont in the mountains, but I hope you can hear me just fine.
We can hear you great. So I have so many questions about this story because I read the article first on Breitbart talking about how there was mounting evidence of the harvesting of organs. Let me just start by saying this. In every other country, of which I understand there is an organ donation base, people wait months, sometimes even years, for a substitute or a transplant from a donor. However, China seems to have a never-ending supply of donor organs. Do you think that's a coincidence?
No, they've actually got it usually down to about 2 weeks. And actually, they've now come out actually a couple of times with emergency liver transplants, which are done in 4 hours, somebody comes in with an acute liver crisis, and 4 hours later, they have a new liver in their body. That can't be done without a large stable of tissue types.
Mm.
It's simply possible.
Talk to me a little bit about the situation that's going on behind the scenes. Obviously, what we're getting fed is Pravda. It's communist propaganda. Now we understand, and again, this goes to the outrageous rhetoric that we're hearing from the communist government. They're sending out of the country American reporters from three major outlets so that they continue in secrecy because no one wants the light being shed on what happens behind the scenes in communist China, and their propaganda efforts began in earnest around January 20th when they realized, listen, this has gotten too big for us to be able to hide any longer. So now we're going back to sort of a dark space in China. But you, having written on this so extensively, talk to me a little bit about this crisis of organ harvesting.
Well, this has been going on for quite some time. I mean, it began in 1995 when they started doing live organ harvesting of what appear to be just regular prisoners, death row criminals and the like. But it was kind of experimental, and it was done in the region of Xinjiang, the Uyghur region of China in the northwest. This is where the Muslims live, that they speak a very different language, and so forth. This then spread in 1997. They started doing the first organ harvesting of political prisoners, again, in Xinjiang, same region. Initially, it was just for, high-ranking cadres, very small groups, kind of like organ tourism within China. Mm. But by 1999, the crackdown of Falun Gong begins. 2 years later, they're harvesting Falun Gong, and the industry, the transplant industry, goes crazy. It just explodes all over China, every region. At the same time, in 2003, we start picking up hints that Eastern Lightning, or the Church of Almighty God, is being harvested, and also Tibetans. So this continues for quite a while, and that's the investigation also continues, or it starts up at about 2006, and then we have an odd thing. We have this massive explosion, but we have a slight slowdown, and that's followed by this massive roundup of the Uyghurs, where you have about 15 million people have to go through blood tests and DNA tests and tests of their organs. And out of those 15 million, about 2 million, approximately 2 million, are put in camps. And this is quite different than the Falun Gong, because the Falun Gong are distributed all throughout the country. This is happening in one region, and it's completely closed off in the world.
Right.
So that is where we reach the real danger zone, a new danger zone, I should say. It's organ harvesting 2.0. The first one is Falun Gong. Organ harvesting 2.0 is more systematic, it's faster, it's quicker, it's more efficient. And it's aimed at specific markets. It's very much aimed at foreign organ tourists. That is, we're particularly looking at the Saudis now because there have been ads and various communications which have run out saying, we can provide halal organs for you.
Oh, so I'm absolutely stunned that people can travel. People who are obviously sufficiently well off enough that they can go on these types of tours. So there's an entirely dedicated, highly specific market for this kind of thing.
That is correct. It is a specific market. At the same time, the Japanese are in it. The South Koreans are in it. They all handle it somewhat differently. They all have their own methods. The Taiwanese used to be big in this field, but it became very controversial in Taiwan, partly through our research. But the point is, we have a problem when COVID-19 appears, because that huge transplant industry is suddenly in deep trouble. I mean, who wants to go to a Chinese hospital right now?
Right.
So, and then, so when this announcement, and it was very splashy in the Chinese press, the double organ, double lung transplant, came along. I read it, and that's clearly an advertisement aimed at the world to say we are open for business. We are continuing to do transplants. We're not going to, and look, we can even do them if you get COVID-19. that's a pretty aggressive way of handling this. It's a pretty good way of making lemons out of lemonade.
Right.
Lemons into lemonade. I mean, it's pretty good. You know, we don't know that that's absolutely the case, that this is an advertisement. We can't say that they framed it exactly that way, but it sure reads to me that way. There was no reason for them to come out with that story.
So you see an article like this, you see these headlines, and you're seeing that they're touting through state-run media the successful double lung transplant. And as somebody who has written on this and who has studied it at depth, and that's another question I'd love to ask you after this one.
Well, let's just put it, just there's one thing. You just mentioned the double lung transplant. Let's put that in monetary terms. This is approximately $300,000 or more. That's $300,000 to an American organ tourist, all right? That's what we'd be willing to pay. That's
wow.
Saudis, or certainly Japanese, would be willing to pay 2 to 3 times that, right? Especially Japanese who hate to bargain over these kinds of things. So, in fact, what we're looking at, now you see the problem. All those people who are in these concentration camps are worth a tremendous amount of money.
Sure.
I mean, each one of them is worth $500,000 to possibly $1 million if they are organ harvested, very carefully, and they line up all the patients. And there are various methods to do that, including ECMO and some other methods which bring oxygen to the organs and can keep them alive for a lot longer. That is a really perverse incentive to kill these people. And in my own research, is picking up the fact that I think we're seeing 2.5 to 5% of those people disappearing every year.
Oh, wow. That's absolutely outrageous.
These are rather large numbers. I mean, they're numbers. I mean, okay, numbers in China always make you kind of go, oh, wow, right?
Right.
They're so big. But this is a massive industry. This is their hospitals would specialize in transplants all over the country. They built the wards. They have the surgical teams. They have the beds. They don't really want to be treating COVID patients. They want to be doing this.
Right.
Okay?
And yet it's thrown them into the national spotlight, the international spotlight, because they have used one of their own successful double lung transplants as sort of the flag that flows over the entire country's success. And you said it so perfectly. This is a way to turn lemons into lemonade. Look, well, okay, it originated here. We won't fess up to that fact. And in fact, the Americans are lying about it because it's probably an American virus. But look what we were able to do despite that, when in fact it has come to a $300,000 price tag. I mean, Ethan, my jaw is hanging open. This is stunning.
Yeah, it is really an amazing, it's an amazing field, and it's amazing that the Chinese have gotten away with it. And one of the key reasons they've gotten away with it is the World Health Organization, which now everybody's very familiar with.
Right.
Everybody's watched them get their press conferences and praise China again and again for their openness, their transparency, the way they've handled this with such respect to the patients. I don't know if they actually use that phrase. I just scratch that. But, you know, come on, that's sort of along the line, the humanitarian,
right.
You know, the humanitarian impulses.
Right.
You know, these are people, the Chinese did an incredible job welding people into their apartments. I have no, that's the way to do it if you have an authoritarian state, and you can do
right.
That kind of sense. But the point is, the WHO, which I've always felt sympathetic to because they have to have that access to China, the price they pay is just too high. I mean, this is ridiculous. They've become an arm of the propaganda team in China. And that's really sad to see. And I'm not even sure the group can be reformed at this point, which is a frightening thought. I mean, we need an international organization which does this kind of stuff, which looks for viruses and monitors things like organ harvesting even. And,
yes.
And so forth. But we don't have one at present. We have nothing.
No.
And that's why the Chinese have been able to get away with this. Everybody's so scared of China, or so scared in the medical world, they're terrified of being left behind. They think China will come up with some great medical breakthrough, and they won't be part of it. I've seen the future. It's China, that kind of thing.
Right.
So this is a really, really big problem, and it is a terrible tragedy for those on the ground, and it's a terrible tragedy for medicine in general. And now we're seeing it play out in our own society in a strange way.
Your book has been critically acclaimed, and it's very interesting. I read Bill Kristol's endorsement of the book, talking about how it was gripping, horrifying, and infuriating. And I have to ask, in the couple of minutes we have left, what was it like to go inside and experience this up close while you were writing the book?
You know, I never went into China. I mean, I've lived in China for quite a few years, but I never went into China to research this. And the reason why was because I just simply would have gotten people killed, okay, by doing that. And I'm not willing, that's sort of my line, is I'm not willing to say, you know, this is such an important cause that people have to die for it. No, I really don't want to live with that. So what I did was I interviewed people that were refugees, and there were lots of them. Reporters weren't interested in them. I was. I went all over the world interviewing them very closely. The interviews I didn't like, where I felt they were trying to lead me on in some way, I threw them out, okay? I would interview people for 5 hours, 6 hours at a time, just simply to try to assess their credibility. I wouldn't let them know what I was interested in. I'd ask them about all kinds of things, right? So it was a complicated process. But I have to say, you know, it's one of these things. I'm afraid the answer is rather banal. You get used to it like anything else. It's a job. Nice. You must stick with that job. I was tempted to leave this field a couple of years ago, but then the Chinese started up again. I always thought I was writing about history in this thing. I always thought, why would they continue to do this? Right? This is madness. But now with the COVID-19 stuff, we're seeing echoes of that, of how corrupt a field this is. There is some evidence. It's sketchy, and I'm not claiming it's widespread, but there is some testimony coming out of China now that they are killing old people, just simply incinerating them, and they're still alive. Maybe they're, you know, on the way to death, okay? Maybe they've got one foot in the grave, perhaps. But there's some evidence of that. And, you know, we can't just write that off anymore because this has been live organ harvesting throughout this entire period. Yeah?
Right.
We can't just say, well, that's impossible. No, it's quite possible. This is a culture where doctors have had to do forced abortions for, you know, decades now, decade after decade. And they've also been involved in live organ harvesting. Not every doctor, not every surgeon. There are special surgeons who specialize in this. They're actually kind of famous because they're very rich. They drive fancy cars. They have very nice calligraphy. Okay, but the point is, that's what we're looking at. Maybe it's a specialized group, but this is in that medical culture, and this is what we have to decouple.
Ethan Guttman, who has been my guest today, author of Slaughter, Mass Killings, Organ Harvesting, and China's Secret Solution to its Dissident Problem. You can find the book on Amazon, but we encourage you, listeners, pay attention, do your homework, continue to follow the stories coming out of China. We'll see you next time on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.